And on some of these verses here as we begin, we're not going to spend a lot of time in them, like these four verses here, Hebrews 11:20. By faith, Isaac blessed Jacob and Esau in regard to their future. By faith, Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of Joseph's sons and worshipped as he leaned on the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, when his end was near, spoke about the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt and gave instructions about his bones. By faith, Moses' parents hid him for 3 months after he was born because they saw he was no ordinary child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. In each of these, because we're talking about faith, and it's the conviction of the things that are unseen. They were sure of these things happening. Isaac's blessing to Jacob and Esau, when he gave it to Jacob, and Esau came, he said, I already gave that one. It was, in his mind, it was a sure thing. It was given. It was gone. He said, well, I can give you this. Kind of gave him a little blessing. But the main one went because, and they believed those things. Jacob blessed Joseph's sons. Ephraim is going to be greater than Manasseh. Well, how do you know that? I don't know if the Lord told him that. It must have told him something for him to be doing that. Joseph, he talked about the Exodus. He knew it was coming. Well, we know scripturally in the book of Genesis, it says 4 generations. How he knew, I'm not sure, but he said, I know it's going to happen. When you guys go, you take my bones. He absolutely knew, even though he hadn't seen anything taking place. Same thing with Moses' parents. In all of these, there's looking to the future with a certainty that God's going to do all that he's promised. In verse 24, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be known as Pharaoh, the son of Pharaoh's daughter. He refused to be known as Pharaoh's daughter. Yes, I would too. As a son of Pharaoh's daughter. He chose to be mistreated along with the people of God rather than to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a short time. He regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as greater value than the treasures of Egypt because he was looking ahead to his reward. In Acts 7:22 it says, Moses was educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, was powerful in speech and action. When Moses was 40 years old, he decided to visit his fellow Israelites. He saw one of them being mistreated by an Egyptian, so he went to his defense and avenged him by killing the Egyptian. Moses thought that his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them, but they did not. So here we have a guy who spent roughly 37 years in the household of Pharaoh because I'm guessing that he was around 3 years old when he was weaned. Now he's 40. So 37 years he's been in this household getting all this influence. And it says that he thought his own people would realize that God was using him to rescue them. See, a lot of times we look at, well, Moses saw the burning bush and God said, go deliver him. Well, no. He thought they would realize that God was using him then. So he had some idea of God using him. Now, it also says in this verse that we're looking at that he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ. When did Moses see Jesus? There's no account of that. How could he have said, well, I'm counting all this loss for Jesus, for Christ? Well, he had some insight. In the scriptures here, he had insight about the Messiah. It just doesn't tell us when he received it. Acts 7:37. This is that Moses which said to the children of Israel, a prophet shall the Lord your God raise up unto you of your brethren, like unto me, him shall you hear. Who's that talking about? Who's this other prophet that they should hear? Jesus. So he had some type of insight to where he was willing to be disgraced for Christ rather than have the pleasures of Egypt. You say, well, that doesn't really make sense. Look in John 8:56. Says, your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad. When did he see it? When did Abraham see Jesus? Might have been there at the tree. But it's talking partially about he could see the day coming. There was that impartation that there's going to be the Messiah. I'm not sure how all these guys got their insight besides from the Holy Ghost. I don't know how much of it was passed down, how much of it's actually talking about the anticipation that they had for what was coming down the pike. But anyhow, he regarded disgrace for the sake of Christ as greater value than the treasures of Egypt, because he was looking ahead to his reward. The last bullet there, this whole section of Hebrews is showing that there needs to be a looking forward to what God has in store for us so we may set the priority of our hearts. God's reward is far greater than any temporary pleasures of this life. This is what helps us to remain faithful and strong. Faith has a hold of things that we cannot see. Verse 27, by faith he left Egypt, not fearing the king's anger. He persevered because he saw him who is invisible. By faith he kept the Passover and sprinkling of blood so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. This verse just ties in back to verse 1 of this chapter where it says, faith is a title deed of things hoped for. He saw him who is invisible. Well, how do you see him? By faith. I know that I know. And in 2 Corinthians 4:16, it says, for which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, while we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. How many of you guys spend time looking at the things that are not seen? I'm looking at the unseen, and it's still unseen. But there's something we should be looking towards. We're not seeing it, but the reality of it's given in the Scripture. We have a hope that's set before us. We have things that the Scriptures place before us that we need to be looking toward because they should be a driving factor in our hearts. And you got to be persuaded. If you're not persuaded of something, how diligently are you going to pursue something? Yeah, I really need to exercise, but I'd rather be eating. Guess what you're going to do? You're going to go over and eat. Whatever the discipline, whatever the thing, if we don't have a strong enough motivation, and part of it is seeing that Without faith, it's impossible to please God, because he that comes to God must believe that he is, and that he's a rewarder of those that diligently seek him. So are we pursuing him to get what he has for us? Do we see it to where we can count the things, like Moses said, he had the pleasures and the treasures of Egypt right there in front of him. He said, I would rather face disgrace with Christ than to live the rest of my life having that. It put a value system and a priority in his life. And we need to be seeing the unseen. In Colossians 1:15, it says, Jesus is the image of the invisible God. So we can kind of see God through Jesus. 1 Timothy 1:17, now unto the King eternal, immortal, invisible, the only wise God, be honor and glory forever and ever. We can't see him, but yet we know he's there. And we need to pursue those. John 6:43, for no one can come to me unless the Father who sent me draws them to me, and at the last day I will raise them up. As it's written in the scriptures, they will all be taught by God. Everyone who listens to the Father and learns from him comes to me. Not that anyone has ever seen the Father, only I who was sent from God have seen him. He's the invisible God. But Moses was looking towards that invisible God. He kept the Passover sprinkling of blood because he believed it. In verse 29, by faith the people passed through the Red Sea as on dry land, but when the Egyptians tried to do so, they were drowned. So here's Israel walking through the sea by faith because God said, go through. Moses held the rod up. Everything split open. And the Egyptians saw the sea split and they went in. But did they go in by faith? Or did they go in by sight? Hey, if they can do it, I can do it. Kind of like the seven sons of Sceva. Hey, if Paul could cast out demons by name of Jesus, we can do it. Doesn't work. Because they didn't have the heart. They didn't have the faith. And so I think I would have felt a little bit of a adrenaline rush if I was some of the last of the Israelites with the Egyptians coming. And I'm not sure how it happened, but I mean, you see them coming, you know you're at the tail end. But then you're seeing the water start to go over the Egyptians. And it's like, is that stuff going to overtake me too? That had to be a strange sight. Because here's the whole Egyptian army, all their chariots, and the waves are just crashing. Not one of those guys survived that. But Israelites just walked through. And they were safe. By faith, verse 30, the walls of Jericho fell after people marched around him for 7 days. If they didn't believe the Lord, would they have marched around it? I'll tell you, because they're just like us. And I know you guys have had this happen, where a supervisor tells you to do something that you know is absolutely stupid. And sometimes we've failed and we've said it's absolutely stupid, and we kind of gossip with those around us. Isn't that stupid? Blah, 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 blah. Other times we've told the boss, I don't think that's right. And there's a proper way of handling that. But a lot of people have this mentality, that's so stupid. I'm not doing that. That boss is stupid. Well, here's God telling them, just march around the city. Don't say a word. March around. Then go back to camp. Did 6 days. And then on the seventh one, go around it 7 times. And then just shout. Oh, yeah. walls so thick they could ride chariots. I forget how many abreast up there. If they didn't believe God, the unseen, he said he'll do it. Don't know how it's going to work, but this is what he wants. And they fell. Verse 31, by faith, the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. She knew, and there's a scripture, Joshua 2:9, that the Lord had given Israel the land. She expressed her belief in the Lord by risking her life to hide the men, as well as asking for protection for her family. She knew that they were going to conquer the city. She as well had heard the stories of the Red Sea and about the Jordan splitting. But in her heart, she believed. And she wasn't destroyed with the others in Jericho. Verse 32, what more shall I say? I don't have a time to tell about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, who became powerful in battle, routed foreign armies. These examples are talking about some obvious victories. These are ones we always want to, yes, man, I'd like to be able to shut the mouths of lions to see God moving and just... Let's read the next part of the verse. It starts off with another positive. Women receive their dead, raised back to life again. But then it goes on kind of this... Looks kind of negative. Others were tortured. That doesn't sound good. And they refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawed in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins, goatskins, destitute, persecuted, mistreated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and caves and holes in the ground. Are you saying they had faith? Yes. Because faith does not equal having everything go smooth in your life. Faith means remaining consistent in your belief in God, even when the things come against you. Endurance, to me, seems to take a lot more faith than just the escaping part. Like, oh, look, the mouths of the lions are shut. Wow, that was great. But what about when you're on the run and you're wandering in these deserts and mountains, caves, sheepskins, goatskins, persecuted, mistreated, and you're saying, where's the fulfillment of your promises? Because we start looking immediately to all our natural needs. And, hey, it's not supposed to happen this way. I'm supposed to be protected. 10,000 will fall at my right hand and nothing will happen to me. Tell that to those guys. They had stuff happen to them, but they endured. What has the writer of Hebrews been trying to get these people to see that they need to do?
Hold on.
Endure. Persevere. Because they'd been letting things slip. And so he's giving them examples. Do you remember we read in chapter 6, it says, follow the example of those who through faith inherit the promises. Well, now he's laying out these examples. Some were marvelous. Others suffered. Verse 39 says, these were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us so that only together with us would they be made perfect. They looked forward to the promise. Their faith kept them focused on living their lives toward that goal, even though they didn't receive it. Reflect back on what was said in the last chapter in Hebrews 10:35. It said, "Do not throw away this confident trust in the Lord. Remember the great reward it brings you. Patient endurance is what you need now so that you will continue to do God's will. Then you will receive all that He has promised. For in just a little while, the coming one will come and not delay. And my righteous ones will live by faith, but I will take no pleasure in anyone who turns away. But we are not like those who turn away from God to their own destruction. We are the faithful ones whose souls will be saved." So this chapter is showing examples of people who have not turned away and that it was accomplished by faith. These examples show that they believed in God and He's a rewarder of those that seek Him. These people needed some illustration. They needed something to see that what faith was, examples of it. They needed to be stirred and motivated so that they would not give in. Here from this commentary, Hebrews 11:39, God having provided some better thing for us. This is a dispensation of the gospel with all the privileges and advantages it confers. That they without us should not be made perfect. Believers before the flood, after the flood, under the law, and since the law, make but one church. The gospel dispensation is the last, and the church cannot be considered complete until the believers under all dispensations are gathered together. As the gospel is the last dispensation, the preceding believers cannot be consummated even in glory until the gospel church arrive in the heaven of heavens. There are a great variety of meanings put on this place, but the above seems the most simple and consistent. Revelation 6:11 says, "White robes were given to them, every one of them. It was said unto them that they should rest for a season until their fellow servants also and their brethren that should be killed as they were should be fulfilled. This time and its blessings are now upon the wing." I'm not sure I necessarily believe every statement in that commentary, but he's talking about believers before the flood, after the flood, under the law, since the law. We are going to all be made one in Christ. And God having provided some better thing for us. Aren't you glad it didn't end 40, 50, 60 years ago? Okay, that dispensation's done. We'd be hurting. And I'm glad that He's still got a plan right now, that we're still in the time of the Gentiles. He's still reaching out and moving in our lives. So now, it continues to move on. He says, "Therefore, since we're surrounded by such a huge crowd of witnesses to the life of faith, let us strip off every weight that slows us down, especially the sin that so easily trips us up. Let us run with endurance the race God has set before us." King James uses the term cloud of witnesses. And the word cloud means not a single sharply defined cloud, but a great mass of cloud filling the heaven. It's just talking about this broad spectrum of witnesses to life of faith. And they've testified through their life that you can hang on even when you're being sawn in half. So because of that, let's strip off every weight that hinders us. He's saying, look, these guys were able to do it. You can do it. But they persevered. You have to persevere. And here's how you do it. One of the ways you do it, you got to get rid of the weight that slows us down. Here's the definition. Render it encumbrance, according to the figure of a racer who puts away everything which may hinder his running. So the readers are exhorted to lay aside every worldly hindrance or embarrassment to the Christian career. Another one is, the word is agkon, bulk, mass, hence a swelling, superfluous flesh. The allusion, therefore, is to the training period preparatory to a race in which encumbering superfluity of flesh is reduced, expositor says, the Christian runner must rid himself even of innocent things which might retard him. And all that does not help hinders. It's by running he learns what these things are. So long as he stands, he does not feel that they are burdensome or hampering. Thus the word weight has the idea of encumbrance. Now they had one point in there that I just had to stop. It's by running that you learn what the weights are. That means if you're just sitting here saying, okay, well, God, I really don't know what things are hindering me. I need to just sit and meditate on this. You're not going to find out. I run, so I know that there are things that hinder you. I don't like running with ankle weights. They might help strengthen you, but they sure make running a drag. And if you have feet as big as mine, they're heavy enough without the weights. You don't want stuff that's slowing you down. But if you just are sitting there with the ankle weights on, how bad is it? You don't know that you have something that's going to hinder you. It's not until you get up and begin doing the thing you're supposed to be doing. And in this case, walking the walk. And he's saying, hey, look, you've got stuff that weights it. And it says in it, I believe it to be true, it can be innocent stuff. But anything that hinders, that doesn't help, hinders. And you can go, I'm just saying this because I'm not pointing finger at anybody, I'm just trying to throw out some example. It's kind of like in this world, the more toys you have, oh yeah, I got this, I got that. Well, you know what? How much of your time goes in to keeping this thing maintained as well as playing with it? And then you've got this over here. You start adding up the time. Well, I didn't have time for reading and prayer or for really fellowship or things of God. What is it that's hindering you? I'm not saying we can't have those things. I'm just saying a lot of people do not realize where their time goes. They also don't know where their money goes. That's why I tie the two together, because I've seen it. My wife has worked with some ladies that... they're absolutely broke before the end of the month, but they would buy things at work to eat all the time instead of bagging from home. They smoked, which was another expense. And they'd say, well, I don't know where my money went. You got to add it up. You got to take a look at it. Same thing with our lives. Where is our time going? What are we doing? What are the things that are affecting us in our race? The definition of easily besetting. We know what sin is, but here's the easily besetting. Not only are the readers to lay aside every general encumbrance which would slacken their speed in the Christian race, but also any particular specific one. The words easily beset are the translation of these words meaning readily, deftly, cleverly, and the verbal form of the rest of the word to place itself around. It speaks of a sin which readily or easily encircles a Christian runner like a long loose robe clinging to his limbs. The sin may be any evil propensity. From another definition, from readily, deftly, cleverly, to place itself around, a sin which readily or easily entangles a Christian runner. Beset is a good rendering, meaning to surround. The verbal adjective reminds one of a ring of wild beasts in a jungle that encircle the campfire at night, each ready to pounce on a careless victim. Another one is pertaining to easily distracting one's thinking. easily distracting, that which keeps one from continuing to think about something. So very possibly one of the sins that easily besets us is a sin of unbelief that the author spoke about in chapter 3. That's what he is forewarning them about, because they were letting things drift. They were hardening their hearts, not believing them. You say, well, man, those guys really had problems. We do too. What happens to your heart if you don't stay on top of it and grab a hold of some other principles of God that help us see it is when you pray for somebody to be healed and they're not healed, and you pray to be healed and you're not healed. Some people just come to a point where they just say, well, it just doesn't work. What's happened? Slowly that thing has affected their heart because they didn't have other principles coming in to give them life, saying, okay, I could have missed it. There could have been sin there. It could have been God's timing. There are some varying factors. I'm not God. I don't know everything, but I do know that you heal. And so I'm going to continue praying. I'm going to continue asking until you tell me, no, I shouldn't do that. But see, we need the rest of the Word of God to continue to impart to us so that we don't have this stuff just hardening our hearts, and like a loose rope. I mean, you're running and this thing starts wrapping around you. I've never worn a dress, so I don't know what it would be like to run in a dress just hindering you around your ankles. But I can understand the concept of something coming loose and just, I've tripped over enough cords that I've worked with. I know what easily besetting is. Easily. Now he is talking to people like us. It's stuff that comes, it's just waiting, just walking around you. It could be an area that you've struggled with for a long time, and it just kind of seems to be circling, waiting for you to just make another mistake. And he says, we need to lay aside the easily besetting sins. We need to find and strengthen those things. We're going to go on in this chapter, and he says, strengthen the feeble knees. Lift up those tired hands. He's saying, you guys need to have some life pumped into you, because you got to keep your eyes up here on Jesus. And that's what he moves into next. Actually, one more point there. It's a race that requires endurance. The Greek word patience, hupomone, includes both passive endurance and active persistence. I was trying to get a handle on understanding what passive endurance, and I ran by Cindy just talking to her. Best I could come up with, if somebody else has a hold of it, let me know. But just a passive endurance, you have the capability to endure, but there's an active persistence that you're continuing to push on. So this enduring, and it is that way in our lives. I mean, we come to a place where we've learned to endure to a certain extent, and then we're facing maybe the same thing, but in a little deeper manner. Now we got to go through it. Use anger. You might have been somebody that blew your top before you got saved. I mean, just easily. Over the years, God worked on you. But it's still not totally rooted out. I mean, it's a lot better. But you've got to learn to endure, to go through a trial that just causes you to start feeling that anger. And you go, okay, he's been faithful. He's taught me these things. He's trying to teach me one more. I'm going to persevere. I'm going to push through this one. And so that's what I see when I read that. I'm not sure if that's what he meant, but that's my understanding of passive endurance and active persistence. So how do we do this? By keeping our eyes, verse 2, on Jesus, the champion who initiates and perfects our faith because of the joy awaiting him. He endured the cross, disregarding its shame. Now he's seated in a place of honor beside God's throne. The word looking onto means to turn your eyes away from other things and fix them on something. Well, I really like the things of the world. Guess where you're going to be looking? At the things of the world. He's saying, fix your eyes on Jesus. To look away steadfastly or intently toward a distant object, metaphorically to behold in the mind, to fix the mind upon. In other words, to develop more precise knowledge about something, just really focusing in on a particular thing. To look away from one thing so as to see another. Do they call that wall-eyed when your eyes kind of go out? I know this is cross-eyed, but is that wall-eyed? They've got a term. But anyhow, you know, it's not right if your eyes are doing this because they work together. You're supposed to be focused. And so we got to look away from one thing to see another. And it seems like a simple concept, but guess what? People struggle with it all the time. He's saying, look to him. Focus your mind on him. That's one of the ways that we're running this race, by keeping our eyes on him. It's when we take our eyes off of him that the stuff starts wrapping around our feet, the easily besetting. We start grabbing a hold of stuff that's just weighting us down. You're loading it in your pockets. I carry a lot of stuff at work. I'm working and all of a sudden it's, oh, I need a crescent wrench. I stick that in my pocket. And oh yeah, I got to go over here. I got my tool bag right there, but I'm working. I'd like to be able to. It's a good thing I have a belt on most times. I got so much stuff, it's just weighting me down. We do that in the natural. We begin to take things on in our lives that might be very innocent, and we don't realize the weight that it's all starting to add up. We just need to be able to look to him, to keep from loading ourselves up with things that are going to actually be detrimental in the long run. It says, we look unto him who's the author and finisher of our faith in the King James. It's the same word, captain, in Hebrews 2:10. He's the one who initiates and completes our faith. He looked ahead to the joy set before him. The reward before him enabled him to go through the suffering and cross. And there's a sentence I didn't finish in there, not regarding the shame. He was disregarding it. He contemned it. He despised it, disdained. He thought little or nothing of it. To consider not important enough to be an object of concern when evaluated against something else. So he looked at the suffering of the cross, he said, that's nothing to be compared to what my Father has for me. Nothing to be compared. In theory, we say that. In little areas of practice, we need to be turning our eyes on Jesus continually. I need to be turning my eyes on Jesus continually. If Jesus needed to look ahead to the joy that was set before him, how much more do we? Jesus had a wonderful relationship with the Father, but he was anticipating the completion of everything. And that just made him just disdain the suffering on the cross. That's what he's trying to tell these people. He said, look, You need to be looking up here, just like Jesus did, so he could just despise the suffering. You guys are going through some suffering, and you're letting it drag you down. It's letting you take your focus off of Jesus, and things are starting to wrap around. You're starting to drift. You're starting to lose things. I've seen better things than you guys. He's given us a better hope. He's given us an anchor for the soul. He's trying to instill and exhort and encourage these Hebrews not to lose what they had. It says, consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men that you won't grow weary and lose heart. The word consider means to consider by weighing, comparing. To consider accurately and distinctly, or again and again. To reason with careful deliberation. And all through this book, the author's been giving reasons and thoughts regarding Jesus and his accomplishments for that very reason. He talked about chapter 1. He's God. He created the world. He's our high priest. He became flesh, but he overcame death. He tasted death for every man. He's a high priest who ever lives. He's been giving them things that, hey, you need to be thinking about these things. You need to be picturing who and what Jesus is, considering him. And then from this commentary, attentively observe and analyze every part of his conduct. Enter into his spirit. Examine his motives and an object. Remember that as he acted, you are called to act. He will furnish you with the same spirit, will support you with the same strength. He bore a continual opposition of sinners against himself, but he conquered by meekness, patience, perseverance. He's left you an example that you should follow his steps. If you trust in him, you'll receive strength. Therefore, howsoever great your opposition may be, you will not grow weary. If you confide in and attentively look to him, you shall have continual courage to go on and never faint in your mind. Here's a continued allusion to the contenders in the Grecian games who, when exhausted in bodily strength and courage, yielded the palm to their opponents and said, "Kamnein," to be weary or exhausted, to be dissolved, disheartened, to have lost all bravery and courage. Yield the palm. I'm not sure if it's hands up, hands down. But he's saying, look, don't be weary in the things that you're doing. I've got to turn to Hebrews here where I have the running commentary in my mind. Consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied. You're ready to just say, I'm in, I'm done, I'm out of the race. The next verse says, in your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your blood. Gee, thanks. Is that what it's going to take? There's two ways to look at this. Both of them fit. I would tend to believe that this is speaking about Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, since the previous verse is also speaking about considering Jesus when he was praying and he sweat, as it were, great drops of blood. But contextually, it could also apply to those mentioned in chapter 11 who gave their lives for the sake of the gospel, to the shedding of blood. So I believe both of those fit in there. But he's saying, look, in your struggle against sin, you haven't faced this point yet. You're still alive. You're still breathing. You're still here. And he says, have you forgotten the encouraging words God spoke to you as his children? My child, don't make light of the Lord's discipline. Don't give up when he corrects you. For the Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes each one he accepts as his child. Kind of seems like an oxymoron. Have you forgotten the encouraging words God spoke to you when he said, I'm going to discipline you. I take comfort in that. I do when it's done. I never really like the discipline when it's taking place. The quotation is from Proverbs 3, 11 and 12. Solomon wrote it as natural father, but here we see the application is from our Heavenly Father. And the writer was saying, have you forgotten those words? Some of the trials they were going through were the chastening of the Lord. The reason they were losing sight of that was discipline is one form of... See, there's another one of those sentences that... The reason that they were losing sight of it was that discipline is one form of love. I have no idea what I was trying to say there. So I'll just take it from my heart, is that they were not seeing that God loved them in the midst of what they were going through, and he was using that. And so they were taking those things as a negative. The natural world tells you you're either an optimist or a pessimist. It's real hard for me if I'm in a pessimistic frame of mind to just pump myself up with like, oh, I'm going to have a good day. It's going to be a great day. That stuff doesn't do much for me, because the whole time it's like, yeah, you're telling yourself that, but it's not going to happen. And there's a pessimistic side coming out. But when I'm going through these trials and viewing them in my own mind, if I look at it his way, if I consider it his way, that begins to change my heart, because I begin to capture his heart. I begin to see through the thing rather than with my own pessimistic mind. I begin to see that God is working something in my life. I need this in my life. I have to go through this thing. And it gives me an ability to go through it, laying aside my carnal thinking and coming back to seeing it his way. Because he's had to, again, I don't know if it's just me or if any of you guys are that way, but he has to hit me with a lot of 2x4s to get things through to me. I'm just a little dense. And it's just taken that over the years. It doesn't always feel good, but every time he's done it, I have gotten a truth that has changed my life. That has become something that I have seen other people need. It's kind of like when you buy a car. You never paid attention to that make and model. All of a sudden, now you're seeing it everywhere. Well, the truths that God gives you and deposits in your life, he does it not just for us, but it's so that we can comfort those who have need. And when that happens, it's like your eyes are open and you start seeing things. It's like, man, I never saw that somebody here has that need. They've got that need. It almost seems like, God, all I'm doing is just sharing this one thing. Well, sometimes that's what it is. It's the thing that's vital. And he's given us a comfort. He's given us a grasp of something. And a lot of it comes through discipline. And we can encourage others with it. And it says, as you endure this divine discipline, remember that God is treating you as his own children. Whoever heard of a child who is never disciplined by its father? If God doesn't discipline you as he does all his children, it means you're illegitimate and are not really his children at all. We need to see that principle, that he's doing it because we are his children. Verse 9, since we respected our earthly fathers who disciplined us, shouldn't we submit even more to the discipline of the Father of our spirits and live forever? That's a pretty simple question. Shouldn't we? Yes. For our earthly fathers disciplined us for a few years doing the best they knew how, but God's discipline is always good for us so that we might share in His holiness. His purpose is for our good, to share in His holiness. And again, sometimes it's hard for us to just see that. That's why we need to be reminded. That's why Hebrews, the third chapter, said, exhort one another daily, lest you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin, because stuff is happening and you're going through it, and God's trying to discipline you so that you can be a partaker of His holiness, and you're losing sight of it, and you need somebody else coming alongside saying, hey, God is working in your life. He's wanting to minister to you. Whatever it's taking for us to exhort one another to be able to stand and continue. No discipline is enjoyable while it's happening. It's painful. But afterward, there will be a peaceful harvest of right living for those who are trained in this way. Here's another place where I lost it. He wants us to learn how to live right. The world has taught us how to live according to its standard. But if we allow Him to train us through these things, we will live righteously. Like I said, I'm going along on a thought, and then I get caught up on something I'm reading that reminds me I need to copy this, paste it over here, and get going. I never got back to the... Here's what he's leading to, Hebrews 12:12. So take a new grip with your tired hands. Strengthen your weak knees. Mark out a straight path for your feet so that those who are weak and lame will not fall but become strong. These guys were letting things slip through their grip. Their knees were getting weak. How many of you get mall knees? How many guys get mall knees? I go to the mall shopping after about two stores. It's like my knees are killing me. It's like I am so tired. I can walk 14 miles. I don't feel tired as I do shopping. I call that mall knees. These guys had mall knees. And he tells them, he says, you need to get a grip. And you need to strengthen those knees so that you don't, and make a straight path for you. Well, where's that straight path go? You got to be looking at Jesus so that you can see the path to take you there. He's saying, set a path, get a grip, strengthen those knees so that you don't become one of those weak and lame and fall, but rather become strong. These guys were babes who had not exercised themselves in the word of righteousness. He already said that in chapter 5. And so they were needing to begin taking these things into their life and putting them into practice. And we're going to have to end right there. We're out of time. So next week, what we are going to do is we're going to finish chapter 12. You've got notes for 13. We might highlight through there, but I will have notes that I'm compiling right now, and I am spell checking and everything, which is a summary, because I'd like to go through the book and tie the chapters together and the thoughts together without any extra scriptures or anything, and without even going through everything in each chapter. I've kind of got the main points so we can catch the flow. That's what I'm wanting to bring out. So we've only got next week to do it. So chapter 13 has a lot of stuff in there. Some of it's basic, some of it's a reminder. And there are a few things in there. So I've got some notes on it, and you'll be able to read through whatever we don't cover here in class to finish out the book. All right, thank you.